Good morning. Welcome to the West Side. I'm Claire Neipert. Criminal punishment in the Middle Ages is known for its brutality. An adult or child who committed even a minor offense might face a flogging, branding, or even execution. During Henry VIII's rule, about 200 crimes, many of them minor offenses, were punishable by death. But out of this age of barbarity came an early form of the correction system that we know today, probation. Influenced by progressive segments of English society, the courts began to temporarily release incarcerated people to give them a chance to secure pardons or lesser sentences. Today, however, a growing body of evidence suggests that community supervision is a primary driver of incarceration. That's happening here in Wisconsin, according to a report from Columbia University's Justice Lab. The research says emphasis on monitoring people under supervision does not lead to their success. Wisconsin has the highest rate of extended supervision among its neighboring states, and the lengths of that supervision are nearly twice the national average. Today on the West Side, we're taking a look at probation and extended supervision in western Wisconsin. Good morning. I'm glad you're with us. Joining us for the hour is Nikki Walsh. She's the leader of FREE, a division of EXPO, or Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, that works to highlight the issues faced by women who've experienced incarceration. She's also a leader at EXPO. Welcome to the West Side, Nikki.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Also here is Mike Felton. Mike is a corrections field supervisor for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. He has 20 years of experience in probation and extended supervision, and 2 years with Restorative Justice. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Our final guest of the day is Kelly Mahoney. Kelly's a data fellow, administrative assistant, and leader at EXPO, which is Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. Hello, Kelly.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're invited to be part of the conversation, too. You can call us at 715-471-6490. That's 715-471-6490. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Well, I want to start with getting some definition and language that we're going to use defined. In Wisconsin, we often hear people use the term extended supervision instead of parole. Mike, what is the difference between parole and extended supervision? Are they the same thing?
Oh, great question. They're actually a bit different. Since 1999 here in Wisconsin, we've had truth in sentencing. And what that did was it allowed judges throughout the state to be consistent how they sentenced. In the fact that someone would go to prison for a certain amount of time, and when they came out, they were guaranteed to be on basically a parole of that type for a certain amount of time, and that was called extended supervision. It had more of a determined amount versus parole, which was prior to 1999. Anybody released from prison at that time was released an indeterminate amount. It depended upon the parole board at that time.
And we'll talk more about that truth in sentencing a little bit later. But I'm wondering, how does extended supervision then differ from probation, Mike?
Absolutely. Now, probation is not it's not a sentence. Probation is a withheld sentence. So any judge, any circuit court would order someone to a term of community supervision. So that would mean that they would be on a probation. What that would also mean then is if they had their probation revoked, and they go back in front of the judge, and the judge might impose a sentence where it could be an extended jail term or possibly prison. At that point, if they went to prison, they would be on extended supervision afterwards. So probation typically is a withheld sentence where someone is not sentenced to a lengthy term of incarceration. It's prior to any prison or lengthy jail term. Extended supervision is after prison.
What type of rules might someone be subject to under probation or extended supervision?
Great question, yes. So we have standardized rules of supervision by statute, and we have updated those in the past few years to definitely be more consistent with the idea that the fewer rules, the better. Research shows that some states have had up to 60 standard rules of supervision, which is way too many for anybody to follow. We've settled on 18 in the state of Wisconsin, the bare minimum that makes sense. A lot of them are about following up with your probation agent, doing as they're told as far as reporting or following up with programming, any judicial conditions, following up with those. following all state, federal, local, municipal laws, etc. One thing that should be noted is that there's no longer two rules of supervision that used to be standard, it seemed like about 15 years ago or so. One used to be no associating with known felons or no associating with known drug users. And that was very onerous. It was something that wasn't used much up in Eau Claire County at all, actually. It was other parts of the state. But that rule has just disappeared. That doesn't make sense. That's very burdensome. Secondly, another rule that has not been standardized, that we're not using anymore, is imposing a no drink, no bar across the board. It does make sense for some clients of ours that we're working with to have that rule, but overall, they would have to earn that rule. People do not standardized have that placed on them right now.
What happens when someone is on extended supervision and that supervision is revoked because of a rule violation?
Great question. So there's a couple different things in that question there. You mentioned rule violation. We have definitely looked at the idea of reincarcerating someone when it comes to they're on extended supervision. There's a chance they might go back to prison for any sort of violations, whether it's rules or new criminal offenses. We have settled on the idea in the past 2 years, definitely looking closely at this, that people should not easily on our supervision earn their way back to prison. It has to be a very difficult road, and there usually has to be new felony charges. Short of that, if it's rules violations, there are other short-term jail sanctions to respond to those. Further, depending upon someone's risk level or the violation level, there are different responses that we can do even short of a jail term. So basically, with our violation responses that have been upgraded and looked at as far as being consistent, someone has to be a very high risk and has to be a very high level violation or new criminal charges pending for someone to go back to prison nowadays.
Kelly, let's go to you now. What do people who've never been impacted by probation or extended supervision need to know and understand about these systems?
I think that, I mean, a lot of the rules that are set upon people are kind of set up for them to fail. So there's a lot of common themes that we hear coming out of people or from people that are on extended supervision and probation. And a lot of it is not really talked about and is something that we need to have more of a conversation around, like more peer support. Probation agents need to be more knowledgeable of their clients, more reentry programs, more of a human factor, and also that people who are on extended supervision and probation feel like they're not a part of the community and that they don't have a lot of support.
Nikki, as a follow-up to what Kelly just said, if someone knows someone who is under community supervision, what can they do to support them?
I think that community engagement and support, the fact that a person is on probation or parole or been incarcerated, they face a lot of different stigma. And when reentering into the community, a lot of people have biases against that. I think that if we were able to help support them through that and offer resources and just lend a helping hand to them, I think that would make a huge difference.
Throughout today's conversation, we're going to be using a lot of jargon, and we've kind of already heard some of that. Kelly, when we're talking about people involved with the criminal justice system, what words should we use and what words should we avoid?
Well, felon, criminal, those are words that, it should be avoided. I mean, inmate is another one. I think, system impacted individual, person who is housed in, instead of inmate, person who is housed in a correctional facility, just using words like mother, father, people-centered language is extremely important.
Nikki, why is it so important for us to be sensitive about the language that we use?
the language that we use around people, it increases that stigma, and it makes a person not feel good about themselves. Kelly, can you jump in here?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people who have dealt with, you know, previous trauma in their life and are already feeling pretty low about themselves, especially when, I mean, a lot of people that are coming out of addiction and, you know, domestic violence, abuse in their family, these words stigmatize them and push them down further than they already are, when we should be working as a community to uplift individuals. And I think that language helps to create being able to uplift them.
The state is ranked third in the country for how long people are supervised, according to a January 2019 report from the Columbia University's Justice Lab. Mike, how is community supervision different in Wisconsin than other states? How does it compare?
Sure, I can address that a bit. So yeah, the Columbia University Criminal Justice Lab report was looking at 2017 numbers there. And really what they were saying overall, Wisconsin does have a large prison capacity. Certainly does. I can use Minnesota as a point of comparison. I started my probation parole career up there in the wild woods of International Falls for about 2 years back in 2001. What I know about the Minnesota system that's different is that the prison system, they have about half of the prison beds that Wisconsin does. So therefore they utilize prison a lot less. They have less on parole or extended supervision over there because it is less. However, in Minnesota, they also have about 250% more people on probation. So overall, they have more justice-impacted individuals in Minnesota than we do over here in Wisconsin. They put everybody basically on probation over there for small offenses or otherwise, which doesn't help out anybody. I think also, too, in Minnesota, they never built more prisons. When you look at like the late 80s or early 90s, Wisconsin, as far as capacity, did at that point. So you have kind of 2 points of comparison there. Let's look at Eau Claire County specifically, and let's look at those 2017 numbers, if you don't mind, as far as data. In Eau Claire, we've had a lot of innovations over the past 15 years. We've had a lot of stakeholders looking at different ways to approach the system. Our Criminal Justice Collaborating Council, set up in 2006, was looking at smarter ways to
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Novo Nordisk, working to improve the lives of people with obesity through knowledge, science, and compassion. Because obesity is a matter of biology, not just willpower. More at truthaboutweight.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive Nerve Relief. Nervive is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet. Learn
in Wisconsin, in Eau Claire, if they were in another county, they might have ended up with a prison sentence instead. Whereas in Eau Claire County, we are willing to say, hey, we have services, we have programs, let's work with you in the community first. So I think that is innovative. So if you're looking at those 2017 numbers for that Columbia University Justice Lab, at that point, we had about 1,237 people on probation. So about 2.8% of the statewide total. However, those that were on extended supervision or parole on supervision in Eau Claire County was only 1.2% of the total statewide population. So we do pretty good as far as not overutilizing prison and not having a ton of extended supervision, therefore, that comes out of that.
What are other states doing differently that might be worth considering here? Do you see any possibility for looking at other states and comparing their systems to ours?
Excellent question. Yeah. I can speak to Minnesota. And again, they're doing some things wrong. I don't want to be a big Minnesota rah-rah fan. And I know we might have some Vikings fans out there too that want me to go down that road. I will not. But what I can say is that Minnesota in 1977 passed the Community Corrections Act. And basically what that did was that incentivized judges in each circuit court to utilize prison less. What that meant was every year they would look at how many people went to prison compared to years past. And any difference there, they would get a little bit more money for treatment, for their social services, for their court system, et cetera. So if each year they're utilizing prison less, they would get more and more money for treatment courts, for inpatient treatment, for other mental health programming, for criminal justice involved individuals. That made a lot of sense. In Wisconsin, we don't have a similar incentivized program for local counties and judges. Each county is pretty much set on their own to do what's right and maybe sentence people to prison a little bit less, which Eau Claire County has done, but there's been no corresponding treatment dollars associated with that. Anything that Eau Claire has done, they've won by grants or just by how well they're doing things. The other thing I've seen is Washington State, kind of similar to Wisconsin a few years back. What they did was they actually said, we are going to not take low-risk people on supervision anymore. Low-risk individuals that are going to be in the justice system are going to have to be supervised by the county, not the state. And they also closed down two prisons at that time. So they really adjusted what they're looking at for their prison population and said, we're only going to focus on medium and high risk individuals in the justice system. So that was about 10 years ago. There might be some value in looking at that as far as adjusting prison population versus who we have on community supervision. So I do think it makes sense as far as an evidence-based practices matter to look at what has worked for other states or what hasn't, and really try to copy some of the best and brightest practices otherwise.
We're taking a look at extended supervision in Western Wisconsin today on the West Side. With us are Mike Felton, the Corrections Field Supervisor with Wisconsin Department of Corrections, Kelly Mahoney, who's a Data Fellow, Administrative Assistant, and Leader at EXPO, which is Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, and Nikki Walsh, a Leader of Free, which is a division of EXPO that works to highlight the issues faced by women who have experienced incarceration. She's also a leader at EXPO. Have you been on probation or extended supervision before? What was your experience? What are your thoughts on how to better these systems? Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or call us at 715-471-6490. I'm Claire Neipert. This is the West Side on the Ideas Network. The Larry Mueller Show is up next on this station. Jack Frost will soon be nipping at your plants. Larry talks about what you can do to help your houseplants, shade-loving perennials, and annuals stay healthy inside through the winter. That's The Larry Mueller Show at 11 on this station. Coming up next week on the West Side, it's time for our legislative update. This time we'll hear from two local legislators about redistricting, water quality, education, and more. Join us next Friday at 10 on this station. Today on the West Side, we're taking a look at community supervision. You can join our conversation by sending us an email at ideas@wpr.org or by calling us at 715-471-6490. I want to take our conversation to talking a little bit more about those rules and requirements that we were speaking about earlier when people are under community supervision. A report from the Pew Charitable Trust suggests that requirements like frequent reporting, ongoing and random drug testing, curfews, and electronic monitoring, and the payment of fees and fines make it difficult for many people on parole and extended supervision to keep a job, maintain stable housing, participate in mental health or drug treatment, and fulfill financial obligations like child support. Mike, in your experience, how have you seen extended supervision or probation requirements affect client success?
Sure, very good question. Some of the things you outlined there are very much protective factors for clients. I mean, you mentioned having a good job. You mentioned being involved with family or school obligations for kids or even for the clients themselves. A lot of times when people are that involved, it is hard to have a lot of extra rules and otherwise. Usually what we end up seeing actually is that clients that have a lot going on positive-wise as far as family, work, employment, et cetera, usually end up as low risk in our system. And what I mean by low risk is that we do an actuarial assessment with them to really find out all the background that they have, and what we're looking at, how we should supervise them. Are they medium or a higher risk to commit new offenses in the future without intervention? What you're talking about is usually a lot of lower risk people. And honestly, they shouldn't necessarily be in the system. They're usually self-correcting. Research would show about 10% of our low-risk clients in the justice system would be self-correcting without any intervention from the justice system. And if only 10% of that is a new recidivism event, that might be something where they can go. And if they're more involved as far as requirements or rules or things that interrupt that kind of cycle, whether it's they couldn't necessarily have a full course caseload because they have other judicial obligations, that might interrupt those things that help them lead a criminal-free lifestyle. Therefore, we really look at a lot of lower-risk people not being involved with the justice system. Other rules you mentioned as far as like curfews or otherwise, those aren't standardized. Some other clients that might have no contacts, that might be in place there. But overall, I'd really say that our rules have been adjusted over the past 2 years, especially to really reflect that we don't want them to interfere with someone's success. And if there are rules that the client feels is impacting their success, they can definitely talk about it. It can be reviewed. And a lot of times those are removed or adjusted.
What about you, Kelly? What do you hear from people in your organization? How do extended supervision or probation requirements impact their daily lives?
Well, a lot. And I mean, for example, so we did this a data blitz project where we went in and interviewed some people in the jail who are on probation and parole. And this was last year, 51% of the people said they cannot easily access treatment. And so I think a lot of people that, I mean, the rules and regulations for most people seems to deter them back to incarceration. Like, having a curfew and you're at work and you have to stay later at work. There's like, sometimes there's leeway, sometimes there isn't. And a lot of people get in trouble because they're past curfew, but they had to stay longer at work. So there's a lot of gray area with certain situations. And it's obviously, I'm sure, case by case, but it does make it more difficult for people. And especially if there's like, let's say somebody, for example, calls in and makes false allegations on someone. A lot of times there isn't an investigation that happens before the person is incarcerated. And so the person is taken out of the community, incarcerated, and then the investigation happens. Well, during that time, they're taken away from their family, their job, and everything. You know, even if it's a couple days in jail on false allegations, it still disrupts their life to the point where it's really hard to come back from that.
Kelly, what are some ways that you think that the system could be adjusted so that people don't run into those barriers?
I think that, like I mentioned, there should be an investigation that happens while the person doesn't necessarily need to be incarcerated for this investigation to happen, especially if it's on allegations. So I think that the person should still be able to be in the community and they can have an investigation and figure it out, because a lot of the times they're finding that these allegations are false and people really shouldn't have to be incarcerated. So I think that that would be a start. I just think that probation officers should be more of a support system instead of a deterring factor.
So, you were mentioning too their recidivism rates, which is when someone who has been previously incarcerated goes back into the system. So I'm wondering, Kelly, how do you see community supervision influencing recidivism rates?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was just looking at statistics the other day about like education and how important it is for people to be able to get their education while they're on probation and parole. And so, like, for example, like the annual cost to incarcerate a single prisoner is $32,000. Annual cost to educate is $1,400. And the annual average recidivism rate right now is 75%. The recidivism rate for prisoners with college educations, an associate degree is 13%, a bachelor's degree is 5.6%, and a master's degree is 0%. And so I think that education is huge and should definitely be pushed, but it's also very difficult when there's a barriers of like court costs, child support. It's hard for a person to just stop everything, go back and get their education without having to work. And then with everything on top of it, with supervision fees, there, I believe, needs to be more of a leeway, or it needs to be structured more towards people having the opportunity to be able to get their education.
Mike, I want to give you a chance to respond to that question, too. How do you see community supervision as it relates to recidivism rates?
Sure, good question. I do want to point out to the listening audience that there is a ton of data that is out there for Wisconsin. It's at wi.doc.gov, our website. Lots of data and research out there. Even recently, in August 2021, we came out with a data highlight there. And just so we're clear about recidivism, it's hard to really have an apples-to-apples comparison, whether state-to-state or state-to-nation. In Wisconsin, we break down recidivism in three different ways. It can either be rearrest, which means that post-prison incarceration, has there been an arrest that happened again, and measure it over the course of 1 to 2 to 3 years. Also, another way of looking at recidivism is reconviction. So that could be a sentence to probation or a new conviction occurring. Otherwise, or maybe it's back to prison. And then finally, a reincarceration rate, which is when someone does go back to prison after being in prison before. So three different ways of looking at recidivism. Most recently, in 2019, the follow-up for a three-year study there was for rearrest for people that had been on extended supervision. For that three-year period was about 52% for new arrests for people that had been in prison in Wisconsin. For reconviction, it was 33.3. So about one-third had a new conviction within 3 years. And then for reincarceration, which means a return to prison, it was about 40.8%. So just so we have numbers there, kind of accurate what we're talking about. I know it was mentioned by Kelly too, the idea of education, which is definitely something that we look at supporting. There are educational programs in prison that can be started in the community. I know that a lot of our work with clients is supporting them if they want to look at a tech school or some sort. Absolutely, there's that. We also do have the CSEP program, which is the Community Corrections Educational Program, which looks at people that have been formerly incarcerated, how they can be supported and how we can work with employers as far as job training support, as far as federal bonding as well, in case they take a chance on one of the clients that has a record of possible dishonesty or theft or something like that. Let's say I'm going to take a chance on you. And if in the first 6 months something happens within that business, there is basically a federal insurance that they have against any sort of criminal act by any client that was given a chance, which is kind of nice to have that set up. Further, any client that is involved with that sort of situation where they say, you know, hey, I want to be involved in this program and the support in this job program, there also are educational stipends that can be worked on and put towards community college, university, or otherwise. So we do have some clients taking part in some of that. Again, education, employment is definitely something that we want to support and help others, our clients that definitely are pursuing that.
We're taking a look at community supervision today on the West Side. I do want to go now to a comment from a listener. This is from Gordy in Eau Claire, and I'll read you what they wrote. They said, the whole system needs to be examined. The people who are supervising are now college-educated young women who have no practical experience from prison life. They don't work weekends and nights and don't hold group meetings, though those are shown to be effective. I do want to switch our conversation now over to talking about caseloads and community supervision officers. Mike, I think you would be best suited to answer or respond to his comment, talking about the importance of practical experience, perhaps, in being a community supervision officer. So how do you respond, Mike?
Sure. I think that what we can look at in the past, I've been in Wisconsin Department of Corrections since 2005, so about past 16 years. And what I've seen as far as our hiring and training of all staff is that it's turned from staff that might only have a corrections or criminal justice degree background to individuals that have more of a social work background, more of a social work understanding. What we want for all of our agents is to be able to work with clients. And that means not just having a check-in where a client comes in and you say, how's it been going? You know, have you stayed crime-free? Good enough, we'll see you next time. But actually working with them, whether it's some skill deficits, whether it's some issues that they have going on as far as coping skills, as far as removing barriers for employment and otherwise, probation parole has definitely undergone a change where we're saying the evidence and research shows how we work with clients matters. And the past 10 years has been revolutionary as far as how we've trained and coached our agents to work better with clients over the years. Your question about as far as lived experience and some of our agents not having necessarily lived experience, that is true. But we do want all of our agents to have empathy and work well with clients and support them. The idea of believing in clients, the idea of helping them find what matters, and values to them, about reconnecting them with the community as they need to and supporting those things is definitely very impactful, very important. And we do support that in our agents and coach that to work well with our clients. And when we do have clients that say, I don't know about my agent, I have some questions, I have some issues, things aren't working out, that's my role. When they reach out to me, I'm able to work with a client a bit better.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Aspiration, a digital banking alternative designed for people who care about the environment. Customers can plant a tree with every swipe. Aspiration.com/green. Aspiration Financial LLC. And from CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike's Falcon platform uses their threat graph to analyze behavior on devices, servers, and cloud workloads to find threats and stop them. More at CrowdStrike.com/ransomware.
It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. We're with Dave Lawler, World News Editor for Axios, Jennifer Williams, Deputy Editor at Foreign Policy, and David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. Before we move on, some news we're watching.
What we're working towards is a resource guide where we're hoping to work with Department of Community Corrections along with all the different organizations out there to try to compile a list of resources to make sure that people have them in their hand. And we've been working with Chippewa County, CJCC, and Eau Claire, and we're hoping to get into Dunn too, to make sure that people are able to hand them out to people as they're reentering society, whether it be from county jails or state institutions or just people on probation and parole, and make sure that they all have access to it.
Mike, back to you. One thing that I've heard, or I'm not sure about actually, I'm wondering, are caseloads rising for community supervision officers? And if they are, how does that impact the job that they do?
Sure, good question. So in Eau Claire County, because we are really following the research and evidence out there, there have been fewer minimum risk clients, low-level clients that don't have a big criminal history, that don't have a lengthy involvement in the justice system. They're being diverted from the system. So what that means is that there is a pretty big pre-diversion, pre-trial, and deferred acceptance of guilty plea systems that are in place in Eau Claire to keep people out of the system. And all three of those have definitely grown over the past few years. So what that means is community corrections is seeing a lot fewer. In fact, between 2016 and 2019, we had 25% fewer minimum risk supervision clients ordered to probation or extended supervision. So that means that we're seeing fewer of those clients. Our numbers have stayed fairly consistent. We have about 1,400, give or take about a dozen or so clients right now on supervision in Eau Claire County. Our probation numbers have dropped a little bit. Our extended supervision numbers have increased. And overall, our level of clients that are medium or higher risk have increased a lot. And that's how it should be. We should be working with clients that are not self-correcting. We should be working with clients that have a lot going on in their background, have been in the system for a while, have been justice involved for a good stretch of time and need more help as far as skill development, treatment, programming, et cetera. That's what we should devote our resources to. The research shows that if we devote resources to those that are minimum risk, that those that are very self-correcting, if we do that, they could become worse, honestly, because we're getting over-involved in their lives. We're interrupting their, as we've already mentioned, their jobs, their family life, their possible school education schedules, right? If we interrupt more of that, the things that make someone less prone or less likely to commit crimes in the future, that interrupts that positive kind of thing that's going on there, and they should not be involved necessarily in community supervision. So some people 10 years ago that might have been placed on probation are not being placed on probation anymore. They're being diverted from the system, period, which is a good thing. Overall, for agent caseloads, they have about 50 plus or minus active clients. Of those, about 10 are on extended supervision. And beyond that, there's usually about 10 more clients that agents would have that are either supervised out of state, are currently incarcerated, et cetera. So usually about 60 is about the capacity for agents right now. I wish it was lower for everybody, but that's where they're about at.
So with that number of clients, how do officers go about making sure that each person gets their individual needs assessed and addressed?
Right, yeah. It is a challenge. I mean, we do try to get a good grasp on everybody by assessing risk and needs right when they come on supervision, all of them. And we work definitely closely individually. Ideally, what would be great to have happen is as we work with clients and they find the resources, treatment, programming, and we work well with that, our clients are able to become less in need of supervision over time. And therefore, the agent then is able to redirect some of the attention that would be towards them, towards others that are either newer on supervision or have violations or have issues that need more addressing. So it's kind of a balancing act. It seems like we'll have clients that kind of come over a hump and are doing great and need less and less involvement in the justice system. And we have clients that relapse or commit new crimes that have more involvement and more attention then at that point. So it's kind of a balancing act.
You're listening to Kelly Mahoney, Nikki Walsh, and Mike Felton. They're our guests today on the West Side for a look at extended supervision and probation systems. When we return, we'll explore solutions that our guests are working on in our area. Your thoughts are welcome. You can join us by calling 715-471-6490 or by emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Spectrum West is back this week at 10 a.m. Thursday. Al Ross shares the interviews highlighting the best and most interesting in the world of arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin. That's the focus of Spectrum West, Thursday at 10 on this station. Well, you're listening to the West Side, where we're talking about community supervision. And now I want to turn our conversation to the solutions that our guests have been working toward in the community. And while we talk about solutions, I first want to address different experiences in the system. Nikki, you help lead the Free Campaign, which is a division of Expo that works to highlight the issues faced by women who've experienced incarceration. Why is it important to have a program like Free in the Chippewa Valley?
Good question. So, like, we know that women have specific, unique needs that differ from men. And that's kind of why Free was formed, was a group of women from Expo had been talking about the differences. You know, when we return into the community, there's different services that we need. A lot of times we are known as the caregivers of the family, and we have to worry about trying to get our children back. Well, with that comes additional needs as far as, like, housing and also the we don't have a lot of services out there that help women deal with the traumas, or if they're going through a, you know, if they have had addiction problems or alcohol problems and stuff like that, as far as resources for services for them. So when women are returning home, they have to worry about themselves, but, you know, they also have to worry about their children and all the different barriers that come with that, including dealing with CPS or DHS, Department of Human Services.
A word that we've heard a lot during today's program, two words actually, is the term lived experience. When we talk about solutions, Nikki, why is it so important to include people who have had that lived experience when we are solving problems?
So we believe that those that are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, meaning that people that have lived experience, who have been through it, understand what it's like to go through it, and we know what works and what doesn't work and the different barriers and challenges, and we see things from a different perspective than the people on the other side. And so when we talk about a person with lived experience, that is one of some of the big things that come to mind, is the fact that we know what works, and it's important to try to include that when making decisions about us.
Last summer, a team of UW-Eau Claire nursing students partnered with several Chippewa Valley organizations, including Expo and Free, on a project titled Returning to the Community, a Quality Improvement Project. And that project focused on examining the gaps, barriers, and challenges that exist for people who have been incarcerated and are reentering the community. Nikki, you worked with this project. How did you see the project help nursing students understand different perspectives, especially when it came to people who are reentering?
So working with the nursing students, I believe it helped give them a different perspective. There's a lot of stigma and biases that go along with people that have addiction or alcohol problems or severe mental health, or who have been incarcerated. And working alongside with them, they got to understand what it's like for us to go through that. And it, a couple of the nursing students that we've worked with, they've expressed how eye-opening it was for them to go work with us and see things from that perspective, because they had never really thought about things that way, you know, like what it's like to be somebody like us, you know, somebody that has an addiction problem. There's a reason that they have that addiction problem, whether that be ACEs, you know, adverse childhood experiences, or some past trauma, or there's usually a bottom line to what's going on with them. So instead of just seeing the addiction, they see a person as a whole, and they look at understanding what is causing that and helping them through that.
Nikki, how do you hope the research from that project can be used to help our larger community?
I think one of the big things that I hope to use it for is education and highlighting the project itself. The nursing students, the first semester, Kelly touched base on the jail data blitz, where they went into the jail and talk to people that were incarcerated. And working with them now, we interview people that are in the community, whether it be their first day back home or they've been out for a little while. And we talk about, you know, why were you incarcerated? What resources do you have? Do you have a safe place to stay? And going through all those questions and finding all the different themes, I think, is one of the biggest things, because we can better educate the community as to why do people keep going back to jail? Why did they go to jail in the first place? And how can we work to solve that?
Kelly, what did you take from the project? What were the biggest highlights of working on that?
So I really liked being able to work with the students and see how their biases, they were realizing things that they had never even thought of before because they had never actually experienced someone in their life who dealt with incarceration or, you know, trauma or, you know, like Nikki said, you know, ACE, high A scores. Also though, that it was interesting to see them take it into like some of the girls that graduated, taking it into their jobs and in the hospitals and seeing how this is really affecting people who are coming in, who have addiction problems. And they were able to see that when without this project, they might not have had that opportunity to be able to remove that bias. And therefore they can help the person. And instead of looking at them as a addict or a criminal record or a felon, they're looking at them as a human being and a person, and they're able to address the issues that are happening to them instead of closing down and not helping them.
Mike, earlier you were mentioning the changes that Eau Claire County specifically has made with these systems. I'm wondering, what goals do you have for the criminal justice system and the community supervision system in our community for these coming years?
Certainly. You know, it was already expressed that the idea of treatment and program and making sure it's available for everybody is accessible. Is a huge thing. We're looking at more and more of that. You know, anybody that wants or needs treatment should be able ideally to get some. And we know that there are resource limitations. I mean, we have our Farman inpatient treatment that we utilize here in Eau Claire, and there is a wait for beds. We do have some transitional living placements as far as apartments set up for clients, but there's a wait list for that too. We don't always have enough resources. Ideally, it'd be great if there was more. Figuring out a way to do that would be wonderful. You know, whether it's, you know, for treatment and programming, connecting to video resources, groups, and otherwise that clients can more easily access. Or even when it comes down to just our topic that we're talking about, as far as working with women in the health system and the criminal justice system, there's been some direction with a recent initiative working with doctors, hospitals, and care providers looking at pregnant mothers who have addiction issues, how to make sure that they get treatment instead of any sort of justice involvement, because treatment really should be the focus there. I think that's going to continue to be a big focus on individuals in the next few years. Beyond that, I would say we would keep working with the local county to make sure our minimum risk clients don't become our clients, that they are still diverted from the system, and that we look at that. For the goals, I would say, are to look at jail and prison as our last resources. We've said it for a long time with our clients that a client definitely has to earn prison or earn jail. It's not something that should come easy because there are so many other options to work with clients. We're going to continue to look at that.
Kelly, in 30 seconds or less, what are your goals when it comes to community supervision and the changes that you could make in our community in the future?
Well, you know, like Mike said, there's a lot of stuff that Eau Claire County is already doing and improving on. And it's actually, I believe that our county is ahead of the game and moving in the right direction, which is, it's great to see a lot of the stuff that Mike was talking about too. I think that peer support and someone with lived experience is pretty huge to maybe have as an extra support person within the Department of Corrections, just to be an extra layer of support for resources and somebody that maybe they can contact at times when they don't know how to help this individual, or just somebody that they can speak to that has that lived experience. I think that would be a big support system to have in the Department of Corrections.
Thank you so much to our guest today, Kelly Mahoney, who works with, she's a leader at EXPO, which is Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, Nikki Walsh, who's a leader of FREE, that's a division of EXPO that helps women whose lives have been infected by incarceration, and Mike Felton. Mike is a corrections field supervisor for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Rick Ryer and Shireen Seward helped produce today's episode. Kate Spranger is our on-air producer. Coming up next week on the West Side, it's time for our legislative update. This time we'll hear from a couple legislators about redistricting, water quality, and education. Join us next Friday at 10 on this station. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Clara Neipert. This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.